Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, the 12th Hour in Elgin, Texas. Today is April 19th, 2025, or it is the 22nd day of Abib 2029. Our second service on this day will be a continuation of chapter 75, where we're in the chapter of Before Annas and the Court of Caiaphas. We're in part 2 on page 704. We're going to continue now until we finish this chapter. It says that for the Caiaphas had regarded Yeshua as his rival for the eagerness of the people to hear their Savior and their apparent readiness to accept his teaching had aroused the bitter jealousy of the high priest. But as the Caiaphas now looked upon the prisoner, he was struck with the admiration for his noble and dignified bearing. A conviction came over him that this man was of kin unto Yahweh the Father. For the next instant, he scornfully banished the thought. Immediately, his voice was heard in the sneering, haughty tones demanding that the Yahshua worked one of his mighty miracles before them. But his words fell upon the Savior's ear as though he heard them not. For the people compared the excited and malignant deportment of Annas and Caiaphas with the calm, majestic bearing of the Yahshua. Even in the minds of that hardened multitude arose the question, is this man of Yahweh like a presence? Is this man of the Yahweh's like presence to be condemned as a criminal? For the Caiaphas perceiving the influence that was obtaining hastened the trial, for the enemies of Yahshua were in a great perplexity, for they were bent on securing his condemnation. But how to accomplish this they knew not, for the members of the council were divided between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. There was bitter animosity and controversy between them. Certain disputes, points they dared not approach for the fear of a quarrel. With a few words, Yahshua could have excited their prejudices against each other, and thus have averted their wrath from himself. For the Caiaphas knew this, and he wished to avoid stirring up a contention, for there were plenty of witnesses to prove that the Yahshua had denounced the priests and scribes, that he had called them hypocrites and murderers. But this testimony, it was not expedient to bring forward, for the Sadducees in their sharp contentions with the Pharisees had used to them similar language, and such testimony would have no weight with the Romans, who were themselves disgusted with the pretensions of the Pharisees. There was abundant evidence that Yahshua had disregarded the traditions of the Jews and had spoken irreverently of many of their ordinances. But in regard unto the tradition, the Pharisees and Sadducees were at sword points, and this evidence also would have no weight with the Romans, for the Yahshua's enemies dared not accuse him of the Sabbath breaking. This and an examination should reveal the character of his work. If his miracles of the healing were brought to light, the very object of the priest would be defeated. False witnesses had been bribed for the accusing of the Asher of the inciting rebellion and seeking for the establishing of a separate government. Really, their testimony proved to be vague and contradictory. With the examination, they falsified their own statement. Early in his ministry, Yahshua had said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." In the figurative language of the prophecy, he had thus foretold his own death and resurrection. He spake of the temple of his body, John 2:19-21. These words the Jews had understood in a literal sense as referring to the temple at Jerusalem. Of all that Yahshua had said, the priest would find nothing to use against him. A right hand of power used against him, I save this. By the ministering of these words, they hoped to gain an advantage, for the Romans had engaged in the rebuilding, and embellishing of the temple, and they took great pride in it. Any contempt shown to it would be sure to excite their indignation. Here the Romans and the Jews, Pharisees and the Sadducees could meet, for all held the temple in great veneration. On this point, two witnesses were found whose testimony was not so contradictory as that of the others had been. One of them, who had been bribed to accuse Yahshua, declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of Yahweh and to build it in 3 days.'" Thus Yahshua's words were misstated. That they had been reported exactly as he spake them, they would not have secured his condemnation even by the Sanhedrin. Had the Asher been a mere man, as the Jews claimed, his declaration would only have indicated an unreasonable, boastful spirit, but could not have been construed into blasphemy, even as misrepresented by the false witnesses. His words contained nothing which would be regarded by the Romans as a crime worthy of death. Patiently, Yahshua listened to the conflicting testimony. No word did he utter in the self-defense. At last, his accusers were entangled, confused, and maddened, for the trial was making no headway. It seemed that their plotting were to fail, for the Theophilus was desperate. One last resort remained. Yahshua must be forced to condemn himself, for the high priest started from the judgment seat, his face contorted with passion, his voice and demeanor plainly indicating that were in his power, he was struck down the prison before him. Answered, thou nothing, he exclaimed, what is it which these witnesses against thee? Yahshua held his peace. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shears is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. Isaiah 53:7. At last Caiaphas, raising his right hand toward heaven, addressed Yahshua in the form of a solemn oath. I adjure thee by the living Yahweh that thou tell us whether thou be the Yahshua, the son of Yahweh. Under this appeal, Yahshua could not remain silent. There was a time to be silent and a time to speak. He had not spoken until directly questioned. He knew that no answer now would make his death certain. But the appeal was made by the highest acknowledged authority of the nation, and in the name of the High Most High, Yahshua could not fail to show proper respect for the law. More than this, his own relation to the Father was called in question. He must plainly declare his character. For Yahshua had said unto his disciples, whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father, which is in heaven, Matthew 10:32. Now by his own example, he repeated the lesson. Every ear was bent to listen, and every eye was fixed on his face. As he answered, thou hast said, the heavenly light seemed to illuminate his pale countenance. As he added, nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. For a moment the divinity of Yahshua passed through his guise of the humanity, where the high priest quailed before the penetrating eyes of the Savior. That look seemed to read his hidden thoughts and burst into his heart. Never in the afterlife did he forget that scathing glance of the persecuted Son of Yahweh. Hereafter said to Yahshua, shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven? In these words, Yahshua presented the reverse of the scene then taking place. For he, the Yahshua of life and glory, would be seated at Yahweh's right hand. He would be the judge of all the earth, and from his decision, there could be no appeal. Then every secret thing would be set in the light of Yahweh's countenance, and judgment be passed upon every man according unto his deeds. For the words of the Yahshua startled the high priest, for the thought that there was to be a resurrection of the dead when all would stand at the bar of the Yahweh to be rewarded according to their works, for they thought of terror to Caiaphas, for he did not wish to believe that in the future he would receive a sentence according unto his works. There rushed before his mind as in a panorama the scenes of the final judgment. For a moment he saw the fearful spectacle of the graves giving up their dead with the secrets he had hoped were forever hidden. For a moment he felt as if standing before the eternal judge whose eye, which sees all things, was reading his soul, bringing to light mysteries supposed to be hidden with the dead. For the same passed from the priest's vision, but thus his words cut him, the Sadducees, to the quick. Caiaphas had denied the doctrine of the resurrection, the judgment, and a future life. Now he was maddened by the satanic fury. Was this man a prisoner before him to assail his most cherished theories, rending his robe at the people might see his pretended honor? He demanded that without further preliminaries the prisoner be condemned for blasphemy. What further need have we of the witnesses? He said, behold, now you have heard his blasphemy. What think you? And they all condemned him. For the conviction mingled with the passion that Caiaphas did as he did. He was furious with himself for believing Yahshua's words, and instead of rending his heart under a deep sense of the truth and confessing that the Yahshua was the Messiah, he rent his priestly robes in a determined resistance. For this act was deeply significant. Little did Caiaphas realize its meaning. And in this act, done to influence the judges and secure the Yahshua's condemnation, the high priest had condemned himself. By the law of Yahweh, he was disqualified for the priesthood, for he had pronounced upon himself the death sentence. For a high priest was not to rend his garment by the Levitical law. Thus was prohibited under sentence of death. This was prohibited under the sentence of death. With no circumstances, on any occasion, was the priest to rend his robe. It was a custom among the Jews for the garments to be rent at the death of friends. This custom, the priest was not to observe. Express command had been given by the Yahshua under Moses concerning this, Leviticus 10:6. Everything worn by the priest was to be made whole and without blemish by those beautiful official garments, was represented the character of the great antitype Yahshua. nothing but the profession and the dress and attitude and the word and spirit should be acceptable unto Yahweh, His holy and His glory and profession must be represented by the earthly servant. Nothing but the profession should properly represent the sacredness of the heavenly service. Finite man might rid his own heart by showing a contrite and humble spirit. For this Yahweh would discern that no rent must be made in the priestly robes, for this would mar the representation of the heavenly son. For the high priest who dared to appear in the holy office and engage in the service of the sanctuary with a rent robe was looked upon as having severed himself from the Yahweh by the rending of his garments. He cut himself off from being a representative of the charity. He was no longer accepted by the Yahweh as an officiating priest. This course of the action, as exhibited by the Caiaphas, showed the human passion, human imperfection. The rending of his garments, Caiaphas made of no effect the law of the Yahweh. To follow the tradition of men, a man-made law provided that in case of blasphemy, a priest might rend his garment in the honor at the sin and be guiltless. Thus the law of Yahweh was made void by the laws of the men. Each action of the high priest was washed with the interest by the people. And Caiaphas thought for effect to display his piety, but in this act the designated or designed as an accusation against Yahshua, he was reviling the one of whom Yahweh had said, "My name is in him." Exodus 23:21. He himself was committing blasphemy. Standing under the condemnation of the Yahweh, he pronounced sentence upon the Yahshua as a blasphemer. When the Caiaphas rent his garment, his act was significant of the place that the Jewish nation as a nation would thereafter occupy toward the Yahweh. The once favored people of Yahweh were separating themselves from him and were fast becoming a people disowned by the Yahweh. When the Yahshua upon the cross cried out, "It is finished," John 19:30, and the veil of the temple was rent in twain, the Holy Watcher declared that the Jewish people had rejected him who was the antitype of all their types. For the substance of all their shadow, Israel was divorced from the Yahweh. Well might Caiaphas then read his official robes, which signified that he claimed to be a representative of the great high priest for no longer they had any meaning for him or for the people. Well might the high priest rent his robe in the hall for himself and for the nation. For the Sanhedrin had pronounced Yahshua worthy of death, but it was contrary unto the Jewish law to try a prisoner by night. In the legal or condemnation, nothing could be done except in the light of the day and before a full session of the council. Notwithstanding this, the Savior was now treated as a condemned criminal and given up unto the to be abused by the lowest and the vilest of the humankind. For the palace of the high priest surrounded an open court in which the soldiers and the multitude had gathered. Through this court, Yahshua was taken to the guard room on the every side, meeting with the mockery of his claim to be the son of Yahweh. For his own words, sitting on the right hand of the power and coming in the clouds of the heaven were generally repeated, while in the guard room awaiting his legal trial, he was not protected. For the ignorant rabble had seen the cruelty with which he was treated before the council, and from this they took license to manifest all the satanic elements of their nature. Yahshua's very nobility and godlike bearing goaded them to madness. His meekness, his innocence, his majestic patience filled them with the hatred born of Satan. Mercy and justice were trampled upon. Never was a criminal treated in so inhuman a manner as was the Son of Yahweh. But a keener anguish rent the heart of Yahshua, for the blow that inflicted the deeper pain no enemy hand should have dealt. While he was undergoing the mockery of an examination before the Caiaphas, Yahshua had been denied by one of his own disciples. After the deserting of their master in the garden, two of the disciples had ventured to follow at a distance for the mob that had Yahshua in charge. These disciples were Peter and John, for the priest recognized John as a well-known disciple of Yahshua and admitted him to the hall, hoping that as he witnessed the humiliation of his leader, he would scorn the idea of such a one being the son of Yahweh. John spoke in favor of Peter and gained an entrance for him also. In the court, a fire had been kindled, for it was the coldest hour of the night, being just before the dawn. A company drew about the fire, and Peter presumptuously took his place with them. He did not wish to be recognized as a disciple of the Yahshua. By the mingling carelessly with the crowd, he hoped to be taken for one of those who had brought gesture to the whole. But as the light flashed upon the Peter's face, the woman who kept the door cast a searching glance upon him. She had noticed that he came in with John, and she marked the look of the dejection on his face and thought that he might be a disciple of Yeshua. She was one of the servants of the Caiaphas household and was curious to know. She said to Peter, "Art not thou also one of this man's disciples?" Peter was startled and confused, for the eyes of the Cananeans instantly fastened upon him. He pretended not to understand her, but she was persistent and said unto those around her, "If this man is with Yeshua." Peter felt compelled to answer and said angrily, "Woman, I knew him not." This was the first denial, and immediately the cock crew. Oh, Peter, no sooner ashamed. Oh, Peter, so soon ashamed of thy master, so soon to deny the Yeshua. For the disciple, John, upon the entrance into the judgment hall, did not try to conceal the fact that he was a follower of Yeshua. He did not mingle with the rough company who were reviling his master. He was not questioned, for he did not assume a false character, and thus lay himself liable to suspicion. He sought a retired corner, secure from the notice of the mob, but as near Yeshua as it was possible for him to be. Here he could see and hear all that took place in the trial of his master, Yeshua. For Peter had not designed that his real character should be known. In the assuming an air of indifference, he had placed himself on the enemy's ground, and he became an easy prey for temptation. If he had been called to fight for his master, he would have been a courageous soldier. But when the finger of scorn was pointed at him, he proved himself as a coward. Many who do not shrink from the active warfare for their Yeshua are driven by the ridicule to deny their faith. By associating with those to whom they should avoid, they place themselves in the way of the temptation. For they invite the enemy to tempt them and are led to say and do that of the which under other circumstances they would never have been guilty. For the disciple Yeshua, who in our day disguises his face through the dread of the suffering or reproach, denies his master as really as did the Peter in the judgment hall. For the Peter tried to show no interest in the trial of his master, but his heart was wrung with the sorrow as he heard the cruel taunt and saw the abuse he was suffering. More than this, he was surprised and angry that Yeshua should humiliate himself and his followers by the submitting to such treatment in order to conceal his true feeling. He endeavored to join with the persecutors of Yeshua and their untimely death. But his appearance was unnatural. He was acting a lie, and while seeking to talk unconcernedly, he could not restrain expression of the indignation at the abuse heaped upon his master. Attention was called to him a second time, and he once again was charged with being a follower of Yeshua. He now declared with an oath, "I do not know the man." Still another opportunity was given him. An hour had passed, and when one of the servants of the high priest, being a near kinsman of the man whose car Peter had cut off, or whose ear Peter had cut off, asked him, "Did not I see thee in the garden with him? Surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth therein." At that, Peter flew into a rage. The disciples of Yeshua were noted for the purity of their language, and in order really to deceive his questioners and justify his assumed character, Peter now denied his master with the cunning and cursing and swearing. Again the cock crew. Peter heard it then, and he remembered the words of Yeshua. "Before the cock crows twice, thou shalt deny me thrice." Mark 14:30. While the degrading oaths were fresh upon the Peter's lips, and the shrill crowing of the cock was still ringing in his ears, the servant turned from the frowning judges and looked full upon his poor disciple. At the same time, Peter's eyes were drawn to his master, to that gentle countenance. He read deep pity and sorrow, but there was no anger there. For the sight of that pale, suffering face, those quivering lips, that look of compassion and forgiveness pierced his heart like an arrow. Conscience was aroused. Memory was active. Peter called to mind his promise of a few short hours before that he would go with the Yeshua to prison and to death. He remembered his grief when the Savior told him in the upper chamber that he would deny the Yeshua three times that same night. Peter has just declared that he knew not Yeshua, but he now realized with the bitter grief how well his master knew him, and how accurately he had read his heart, the falseness of which was unknown, even unto himself. For a tide of the memory rushed over him, his Savior's tender mercy, his kindness and long-suffering, his gentleness and patience toward his erring disciples. All was remembered. He recalled the caution, "Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not. Luke 22, 31 and 32. For he reflected with the horror upon his own ingratitude, his falsehood, and his perjury. Once more, he looked at his master and saw a sacrilegious hand raised to smite him in the face. Unable long to endure the scene, he rushed, heartbroken, from the hall. He pressed on in solitude and darkness. He knew not and cared not whither. At last he found himself in Gethsemane, the scene of a few hours before came vividly to his mind, where the suffering face of his master, stained with the bloody sweat and convulsed with the anguish, rose before him, for he remembered with a bitter remorse that the Yeshua had wept and agonized in prayer alone, while those who should have united with him in that trying hour were sleeping. For he remembered his solemn charge, "Watch and pray that you enter not into temptation." Matthew 26:41. He witnessed again the scene in the judgment hall. It was torture to his bleeding heart to know that he had added the heaviest burden to the Savior's humiliation and grief on the very spot where Yeshua had poured out his soul in agony unto his father. Peter fell upon his face and wished that he might die. It was in the sleeping when Yeshua bade him watch and pray that Peter had prepared the way for his great sin. All the disciples, by sleeping in that critical hour, sustained a great loss, for Yeshua knew that the fiery ordeal through which they were to pass, he knew how Satan would work to paralyze their senses, that they might be unready for the trial. Therefore, it was that he gave them warning. Had those hours in the garden been spent on their watching and prayer, Peter would not have been left to depend upon his own feeble strength. He would not have denied his master had the disciples watched with the Yeshua in his agony. They would have been prepared to behold his suffering upon the cross. They would have understood in some degree the nature of his overpowering anguish. They would have been able to recall his word that foretold his suffering, his death, and his resurrection. Amid the gloom of the most trying hour, some rays of the hope would have lightened up the darkness and sustained their faith. As soon as it was day, the Sanhedrin again assembled, and again John was brought into the council room, where he had declared himself as the son of Yahweh, and they had construed his words into a charge against him. But they could not condemn him on this, for many of them had not been present at the night session, and they had not heard his words. And they knew that the Roman tribunal would find in them nothing worthy of death. But if from his own lips they could all hear those words repeated, their object might be gained. For his claim to the Messiahship they might construe into a seditious political claim. Art thou the Yahshua, they said, tell us. But Yahshua remained as silent, for they continued to ply him with the question. At last, in the tone of their mournful pathos, he answered, if I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go, but that they might be left without excuse, he added the solemn warning, hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of Yahweh. Art thou then the Son of Yahweh? They asked with the one voice. He said unto them, you say that I am, for they cried out, what need we any further witness, for we ourselves have heard of his own mouth. And so by the third condemnation of the Jewish authority, Yahshua was to die. All that was now necessary, they thought was for the Romans to ratify the condemnation and deliver him into their hands. Then came the third scene of the abuse and mockery, where even then them that received from the ignorant rabble in the very presence of the priests and rulers and with their sanction, this took place. Every feeling of the sympathy or humanity had gone out of their hearts. If their arguments were weak and failed to silence his voice, they had other weapons, such as in all ages have been used to silence heretics, suffering, and violence, and death. When the condemnation of Yahshua was pronounced for the judges, a satanic fury took possession of the people, for the roar of their voices was like that of the wild beast, for the crowd made a rush toward the Yahshua, crying, he is guilty. Put him to death. Had it not been for the Roman soldiers, Yahshua would not have lived to be nailed to the cross of Calvary. He would have been torn in pieces before his judges had not Roman authority interfered, and by the force of arms restrained the violence of the mob. Heathen men were angry at the brutal treatment of one against whom nothing had been proved, for the Roman officers declared that the Jews, in the pronouncing of the condemnation upon the Yahshua, were infringing upon the Roman power, and that it was even against the Jewish law to condemn a man to death upon his own testimony. This intervention brought a more momentary lull in the proceedings, but the Jewish leaders were dead alike to pity and to shame. for the priests and rulers forgot the dignity of their office and abused the Son of Yahweh with foul epithet. They taunted him with his parentage. They declared that his presumption in proclaiming himself as the Messiah made him deserving of the most ignominious death, for the most dissolute men engaged in the infamous abuse of the Savior. An old garment was thrown over his head, and his persecutors struck him in the face, saying, "Prophesy unto earth, thou Yahshua, who is he that smote thee?" When the garments were removed, one poor wretch spat in his face. For the angels of Yahweh faithfully recorded every insulting look, word, and act against their beloved commander. One day, the base men who scorned and spat upon the calm, pale face of Yahshua will look upon it in his glory shining brighter than the sun. This is the end of chapter 75, and this is the rest of this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour, calling us number 11. Click on our audio archives here. This is where we're going to close now with a song.